Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will change if the U.S. military eliminates Don't Ask, Don't Tell? The policy was put in place in 1993 as a sort of consolation measure after the Clinton administration failed to strike down discrimination against gay and lesbian service members. At the time, fewer than half of Americans thought it was appropriate for gays and lesbians to serve openly. 17 years later, 3 out of 4 Americans support the idea, and President Obama used part of his first State of the Union address last month to restate his campaign pledge to make it happen. Lawrence J. Korb is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he has written extensively about how to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Larry, welcome to Think.
It's nice to be with you, Chris.
Your sense is that this is not a gay rights issue, it's a military readiness issue. Can you talk about that?
Well, right now, we're fighting two wars, and we need all the qualified people we can get and keep because of the fact that so many people in the service have been deployed so frequently. They're not staying in for the numbers, you know, we would like, but yet we're forcing out people who, you know, have done very well only because it has come to light that they happen to be gay. And while the numbers there, you know, there's been since 1993, you know, it's been in the thousands. More important is the best estimates are based on research done by UCLA that about 4,000 people who would ordinarily would stay in the service get out because they're tired of living a lie. In other words, nobody's outed them directly or indirectly. So you're losing people that you would like to keep. We know that some of the people who've been discharged under this policy speak Arabic, which, of course, we could use in the theaters we are. And then you're also denying yourself a significant, and it's hard to estimate. I've seen estimates, you know, how many people in society are gays and lesbians, but you are denying yourself a number of people who might want to come in the military who can't. And, you know, in 2008, the Army had to give over 8,000 moral waivers just to get the right number of people to come in. So that's why I think it would help military readiness. You'd get and keep, people that you need.
What specifically did Don't Ask, Don't Tell change about the way that homosexuality was tolerated in the military? Did it actually get better?
Yeah, well, what happened, I think it's important to put this into context. Up until 1980, if a person was determined to be gay, it was really up to the commander of the unit to decide whether to keep that person or not. But what happened is some commanders pushed people out, others didn't, so the people who got thrown out went to court. And so in 1980, the Carter administration, basically under pressure from the Justice Department, issued an executive order saying homosexuality is incompatible. So you would actually be asked before you came in, and obviously if it was discovered when you were in there, then you would be forced out. And this is a policy I inherited because I was the Assistant Secretary of Defense dealing with this in the Reagan administration. Then President Clinton, decided that he wanted to change the policy and just, you know, say, you know, go back, you know, just basically say that that's not relevant. And then, of course, this was a compromise. Okay, we wouldn't ask you anymore, and as long as you weren't found out, you could stay in.
And the other thing that changed was that commanding officers were instructed not to pursue this. They weren't to go around trying to ferret out people who might be gay or lesbian.
That's correct. But on the other hand, there's a fine line there. At least initially, a lot of them who did not support the change were aggressive. There's some pretty good documented cases. But this has gotten less over the years. And it's interesting, whenever we go to war, you have less discharges. People forget in the first Persian Gulf War, when the Carter policy was still in effect, they suspended, the discharges of gay and lesbians because they wanted to take them to the war. And then, ironically, after the war ended, then they threw them out.
You know, the term that we've often heard, Larry, in defense of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and of intolerance for homosexuality in the military is that it will affect unit cohesion. Have there been studies to demonstrate that the presence of gays or lesbians in a unit somehow undermine that cohesion?
There's never been a single study done by the Pentagon that has demonstrated that. In fact, the first study was done in 1957 by the Navy. It's called the Crittenden Report that said there's no evidence that demonstrates this. And all the way up to 1993, during the debate on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the RAND Corporation, which is the Pentagon's think tank, also did a study and said it doesn't impact unit cohesion. But I think more important, if you take a look at our neighbors, people who have culture like us, the British, the Canadians, they dropped the ban. They don't have any problems. In fact, they're fighting right alongside of us in Afghanistan, and they have openly gay people serving, and there's no problem on, unit cohesion.
There's also a difference between social cohesion in a unit and task cohesion. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, I mean, task cohesion is, look, doesn't matter who we are, we've got a job to do. And social is, well, I may not like your lifestyle, your beliefs, your politics, whatever it is. So, I'm not going to, go out and have a beer with you or anything like that. And I think that's important. Now, one of the things I learned, I came from a very strict Catholic background. And when I went into the service, I had to deal with a lot of people, who had different ideas about, lots of issues that Catholics feel strongly about. But, again, when, we were flying, that was the least thing we had, in mind. The main thing was, you don't want to accomplish the mission.
What lessons can we learn here from the early years of racial integration in the U.S. military?
Well, I think we can learn a couple of things. First of all, a lot of people in the military will oppose it, as they did back in 1993 when President Clinton tried to change it. And there's a reason for that. The military as an institution is conservative, and I don't mean politically. I mean, they don't like any changes. Like, they didn't like unmanned aircraft. They didn't like aircraft carriers. And then the other reason is that, particularly since the creation of the volunteer military, you've drawn a lot of people who are, have stronger fundamentalist beliefs, if you will, coming in. And so what happened in when President Truman told, the military he was going to, drop the ban on separate units. We used to have separate African-American units and separate white units. The military said, this will ruin the military. And in fact, they didn't do it. They just ignored him. The integration of the Army happens basically during the Korean War, when they sent separate, African-American and white units into the campaign. And then because of the casualties, they could no longer keep them separate. And they integrated them. And, then that ended the debate. The Navy really doesn't integrate till the 1970s under Admiral Zumwalt. Basically, you can learn there will be resistance, that people have strong feelings. They don't like any type of changes. But if there's a ray of light here, it is the fact that in 1993, we didn't do it the whole way. And, 17 years later, society has changed. Young people have changed. And I think Admiral Mullen, summarized that, quite well.
Are you seeing that younger commanders are much more open to this idea than the men and women who are getting close to retirement age?
Oh, well, very definitely. In fact, if you saw the hearing last week where, Admiral Mullen basically said, this is the right thing to do. Senator McCain talked about a letter signed by 1,119, retired generals and admirals. Well, it turns out if you look at that, based upon the analysis we've been able to do, and you haven't get everybody, but we looked at the Navy, some people looked at the Naval Academy, and they said that, nobody graduated from the Naval Academy after 1968. One of the people who signed the letter, his wife signed it to him because the poor man has Alzheimer's and she had power of attorney. So, I mean, I didn't see anybody on there who really had served after Don't Ask, Don't Tell, came in 1993.
Let's talk about this financially for a minute. How much does it cost? And there are a variety of different numbers, but just of the 13,000 who have left the service since Don't Ask, Don't Tell, specifically because of this rule, how much does it cost every time that they have to be replaced with someone else?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, it depends on what you count. GAO has said, the General Accountability Office has said, well, maybe, about, $70, $80 million. A study done by former Secretary of Defense Perry said it's closer to $400 million. But it depends on what you count. I mean, by the time you get a young man or a young woman into the service, get them trained and send them to the unit, you've got over $100,000 invested in them. And then, of course, depending upon, you know, when you force them out, cost you a lot more. And then you have to say, well, if I throw somebody out after 5 years, I got to bring in somebody. How long will it take me, and how much will it cost me to get that man or woman to that, to that level? So I think, you know, it's fair to say it has cost us several hundred million direct costs, since Don't Ask, Don't Tell was enacted.
What steps does the president need to take in order to fully open the military at this point?
Well, actually, you don't really have to do much. I mean, we're doing some studies, and I've talked to the British, and basically the British didn't want to do it. And what happened, they were forced to do it by the European Court of Human Rights, which basically told them in 1999, you know, you want to stay in the European Union, you're going to have to drop this ban. So they did it. And, you know, they didn't publish the regulation until a couple of years after they had done it, but they didn't wait. They just did it. And a lot of the things, well, would you have separate facilities and separate showers and all of those things really are non-issues. I mean, you've got rules and regulations that, you know, determine what you can do and what you can't do. And if you violate them, you should be appropriately punished. Some issues might arise in terms, you know, like they do for people working for the federal government, in terms of, you know, benefits, spouses and civil unions, a lot of things like that. But those are really not military issues. Those can be handled as we do a lot of other issues that don't really impact on the unit's ability to carry out its task.
Do you expect there to be a widespread call for either compensation or reinstatement for recent veterans who have been discharged simply because of their sexual orientation and for no other reason?
What you will see is a couple of things. One, I think they will be, allowed to, come back into the military like other people with prior service. And then I think, again, if they, were denied any type of, GI Bill benefits or recruiting bonuses and things like that, I think they'll be able to get, to get those. When I was in government, we had an interesting case that, fortunately we were able to get to come out right. We had a young man who, in the late 60s, early 70s, was drafted, and he told his draft board he was gay, but they just figured he was trying to get out of, not going to Vietnam. So he went to Vietnam, did very well. They allowed him to reenlist, and he was openly gay. Well, then, of course, when they changed the policy, they threw this guy out. Well, we helped him. He went to court. He got his retirement benefits and all of those things. So I think, you'll have to take a look. Somebody gets thrown out at 18 years and you need 20 years for the, pension, things like that. I think that, will have to be, handled on a case-by-case basis.
Do you see military culture having to change in any substantial way to accommodate this?
No, I don't, because, again, I think, the average age of people in the military is like 23. I don't know about you. I don't know too many 23-year-olds who have the, I'll speak for myself, who have the problem that our generation did with this, if you will, alternative lifestyle. I mean, I remember when I got involved in this debate because I testified in support of President Clinton, my daughter telling me, all these people that say this is a choice, it's just, you don't know that. I mean, why would they choose this given all the problems that it, creates, And this is how young people look at. They don't, it doesn't bother them. And if you talk to most people today, say under the age of 30, they either have a relative or a friend who happens to be gay or lesbian.
Lawrence J. Korb is my guest. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're talking this hour about the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lawrence J. Korb. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're speaking this hour about the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You can find Larry's writings on this at AmericanProgress.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. How do you expect Congress would react to a request to change the Uniform Code of Military Justice?
Well, and you raise an important issue because up until 1993, when they put Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you could change it with an executive order. Either the president or the Secretary of Defense could do it. Now you're going to have to change the law. My guess is what they will probably do is, you know, each year you have a defense authorization bill for the budget, put it as an amendment on there, and repeal it that way, because that's normally not passed till the fall. The Pentagon, Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates mentioned last week, is already beginning to work on, you know, how they will implement that. And so those two things should come together by the end of this year. I think there will be, you know, strong debate. Some people have very strong feelings about this. But in the end, I just don't see it, not passing, because again the country's moved in that direction. And if you look at polls, conservatives, independents, churchgoers, all support changing the policy now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones and speak with Steve in Louisville. Hi, Steve.
Hello there. I was curious to ask you what kind of issues do you have on those that were active duty during the time period I was in, active status of 88, 92, till they say 94, 96, because my experience is, you know, they're very much in the direction of, let me just do my job, basically, you know?
So it wasn't something that, even if you knew there were people around you who were gay or lesbian, it wasn't a concern for you?
No, it wasn't. The concern that I dealt with was dealing with two different words, bigotry and racism. The white supremacists were the biggest issue as far as what I saw when I was active duty in the Navy. I mean, they were the ones that were the biggest headache for anybody.
What do you think about that, Larry?
Well, I think he raised a good point. I think, you know, we overstate the problems, because the best, you know, analysis we can do is about 60,000 people in the service right now who are gay and lesbian. They're not officially out, but people serving with them, you know, and they don't have a problem with it. And he mentioned this other thing. It's the mission that counts. Barry Goldwater, you know, the late Senator Goldwater, the father of modern conservatism, you know, basically said, it doesn't matter if you're straight. Can you shoot straight? And then, of course, you know, you do have, you know, these other, you know, problems that, you know, Steve mentioned, you know, some people have different attitudes or different cultures and things like that you have to deal with. But in the final analysis, you know, the key thing is, you know, can we get the job done? And, you know, I've had some experience during Vietnam, but not to the extent that others have had, or, you know, people, you know, nowadays in Iraq and Afghanistan. But if you talk to them, it's like, why do I care? You know, as long as, you know, that person keeps me alive.
Do you have any statistics at all, Larry, on the percentage of sexual harassment claims within the military that are raised by people who are of the opposite gender as opposed to the same gender?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there. In fact, it's very interesting. In the Army, they have over 3,000 claims a year, and they argue that that's even underreported, because a lot of times when, you know, usually a woman reports that, then, you know, there's an investigation, and she, you know, her career can be hurt as well. So yeah, I mean, you do have those those instances, and unfortunately, I think they're strained by these long deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. But you do have them, and has been a problem ever since we've opened up opportunities for women, which we did. Actually, we started during the war in Vietnam, but really culminated after the first Persian Gulf War, when all the restrictions on women, except for direct ground combat and submarines, were dropped. And, you know, the interesting thing, you raised that subject. In 2005, some groups who were opposed to, you know, letting women, you know, have opportunities in service complained that the Army was violating the rules and regulations by letting them be involved in direct ground combat. And they put an amendment on the defense bill, and the Army came back and said, take it off. You know, we over there in Iraq or Afghanistan, there is no front lines, and we need these women.
We have an email here from Ben in Dallas who writes, why do you think President Obama has not already signed an executive order immediately suspending enforcement of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Well, I think, obviously, I don't think he wants to sign it because there's a question. I agree you could, but some people argue that he can't supersede the law because the law, was passed by Congress. It's no longer an executive order. I happen to think, and I've written this, that he could actually, under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell provision, which basically, as you know, if you're in a unit and let's say your enlistment is supposed to expire next month, your unit gets orders to go to Iraq and Afghanistan, you can't get out until 3 months after it comes back. He could use that authority. And then I think the other is political. I don't think he wants to antagonize Congress because even people who support repealing it are very, very, they want to safeguard Congress's, independence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Emily in Denton. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, while the majority we feel are going to be for this, if it's repealed, does your guest think that there's going to be any threat of, like, hate crimes or of the few that are going to be very against it and, homophobic, if you will? If there's going to be any threat of violence, a rise in the violence against the now openly gay and lesbian community in the military. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think, what you would want to do when you repeal this, and I'll be optimistic because I do think it's going to be repealed, I think is ensure that you have rules and regulations in place or you enforce your existing rules and regulations. And you might need some, type of, training. But there will be people, as, Steve earlier on talked about, people who were, practice bigotry, not against gays, but people, different races. So, there is that danger, and I think you have to guard against it. But I thought Admiral Mullen put it very well last week when he was, criticized for his statement talking about how it's the wrong thing to do to have this policy. He says leadership. And I think that's the key thing. I remember when I was in government in trying to increase opportunities for women, a naval commander came to me and said, "Well, I have no problem with women on the ship, but the wives or the husbands on there are upset." I said, "Well, then it's a question of leadership or putting a man and woman together for 24 hours in a Minuteman silo. What would the quote unquote, wife think?" And I would say, no, I mean, this is a question of leadership and you can't, blame the women or in this case say, well, we shouldn't, drop the ban because you might have problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, Lawrence J. Korb. Let's go back on the phones now to Fort Worth and speak with Taylor. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. Just a couple of comments. I served in the military 34 years ago, and it was really before women had even been fully integrated into the military. And I'm still struggling with how a woman would maintain her modesty in a field-type situation with men. But let me kind of cut to the chase. And, I just feel like everybody has the obligation, or the military has the obligation of providing a non-sexual environment to take a shower, to perform basic hygiene. And, the way I look at this is, the interviewer sounds like an attractive young woman. Would you like to take a shower with me? Well, of course you wouldn't like to do that. And I just think that people should have the opportunity to bathe and dress and take care of themselves and not have to worry about whether they're being a sexual object for somebody else. I just don't think that's right. And it may be that the concept of modesty is so obsolete that the young people today don't find it important. I don't know. But I know it was important when I was growing up, and I would think it would still be important to a lot of them. And that's my only comment. I just feel like the military is a place where people should be able to live that part of their life with some degree of dignity and privacy. And I would like to see what you would say about that.
Well,
I'll take my answer off the air.
I appreciate your call, Taylor. Thanks. What do you think,
well,
Larry?
Taylor, thank you very much for your service. A couple points I'd like to make. You mentioned 34 years ago, there were gays there, and people knew it. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, up until 1980, commanders could keep, you know, gays in their units if they felt it didn't undermine, unit cohesion. So they were there. Number two are the Canadians and the, you know, the British or allies and very similar cultures don't have a problem with allowing openly gay people. In fact, they even allow openly gay people on submarines. And they don't have, you know, any of the problems that you mentioned. And then finally, you know, about 15% of the people in Iraq and Afghanistan are women and are out there on the outposts with the men. And, you know, they don't seem to be having, you know, any of the problems that you raise. I think that there is a, you know, the particularly when it comes to gays, there's kind of this stereotype that, you know, people who happen to be gays are going to be, you know, automatically attracted or you'd be, you know, toward, you know, other people or they're naturally predators. It's simply not true. And the evidence shows, particularly if you look in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly now in Afghanistan, you've got Americans serving right on the outpost with the Canadians and with the British who have openly gay people. And as Admiral Mullen mentioned last week in his testimony, there are no problems.
Do you think, Larry, that some of the, and I have not served in the military, this is sort of my experience from reading things and from watching the movies, so I could be off base, but you'll often see basic training portrayed as a place where, drill sergeants are yelling things like, move along, ladies, to a group of men, and sort of using that as an insult. Will that have to change?
Well, I think it is. I think, you know, it's interesting. One of the first female pilots that got her wings in the Navy after the law was changed, and I might say over the violent opposition of the military, it was done by Congress. The Pentagon didn't want to do it. The, you know, it was then Secretary of Defense Cheney and the military were opposed, and Congress made it. She mentioned, I was on a panel with her recently, and she said when she got to her first squadron, somebody said, I'd rather fly with a blankety blank, not nice term to refer to gay people, than a woman. So, you know, I mean, I think that people might act, in a way that's not appropriate. But I think it's changed. I mean, society's changed so much, and young people so much different. They don't see it as the same problem. Maybe people like Taylor and myself, might have years ago.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Elliot in Dallas. Hi, Elliot.
Hello. I have a quick question regarding just the training you mentioned earlier.
Okay.
And various other kinds of measures people take when a new subculture is introduced into the military, like women and other races. Usually, it's when I served at least, a huge priority on like the feeling of a unit and how they the cohesion of it. So with open homosexuality, which really it is not, from what I've seen, I've known homosexuals who they served and didn't mind serving, and it wasn't really secret because it was everyone pretty much knew anyways. But it seems to me that it might compound other issues as far as how a unit talks to each other and when they're not in a combat status.
So you're saying it would be different if they were openly gay as opposed to everyone knows they're gay but they can't say it out loud?
Well, I think it'll only be different as far as like a judicial, as far as non-judicial punishment is concerned.
Larry, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think he's right. I mean, right now, you're in many cases, you living a lie. You can't be completely honest with the people who, you know, you're serving with and risking, you know, your lives with and on whom you're dependent. So I think it would actually be better. Because as I mentioned, the best estimates, we've got about 60,000 in there already. You're throwing out a couple of hundred a year. So there's a lot of people there that are not. But, you know, that's got an impact on their performance because they can't be, you know, who they are. And going back to the question you raised, yeah, I mean, people are going to have to change their language. They can't accuse, you know, men who can't do the job of being, you know, females, or, you know, use some of these expletives like that pilot did to the, you know, the woman, you know, pilot here, in terms of, you know, the language that they use. But no, I think on balance, it's going to be better. Because can you imagine having to be so guarded in everything that you do? Well, where are you going tonight? Well, I can't tell you, you know, or, gee, I better not go to this place or that place because it's known to be frequented by gays or lesbians and somebody might see me. You know, that type, or, gee, if I have a relationship and, you know, I break it up, is this person going to turn me in? Which has happened to, you know, an Air Force officer with 18 years as a, you know, training as a weapons systems officer. We've got, you know, millions invested in this person, and a jilted, a person, you know, called in and complained about him.
Are there rules now against heterosexual sexual contact in combat situations and on, you know, submarines and in these places that people are very concerned about?
Well, sure. I mean, you've got, in other words, you've got rules and regulations that talk about what people, regardless of their gender or sexual orientation, can do and not do in terms of, you know, when you're on duty. You've got, you know, very appropriate things. And, you know, the way you have seniors have to deal with junior officers. And also there are rules about fraternization. And, you know, I mean, a commanding officer can't, you know, put pressure on an enlisted woman to go out with them. Just things like that. So, yeah, you've got all those rules and regulations. They're already there. And, you know, as the British, you know, the British told me that basically they didn't write the rules and regulations until about 3 years after the change. You know, they didn't even see a need to do that.
Lawrence J. Korb is my guest. He is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're talking this hour about the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lawrence J. Korb, who is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're speaking this hour about the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You can find Larry's writings on this at AmericanProgress.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from James, who writes, "Wouldn't many conservative young men who would otherwise join the military opt out because of the close contact with openly homosexual men?"
Well, I think, obviously, you know, you can't disprove a negative, but in the British and the Canadians, who have cultures like ours, they thought that would happen. It has not, not happened. Obviously, some people, for, you know, reasons, might decide not to do that. But I think, you know, these people should know they're already there. And, you know, a lot of them, everybody knows it. So the idea that you know, they're not there and people don't know, it simply is not true.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I wanted to thank Larry for the comment that he made earlier on the caller that was saying that people needed to have a safe place, you know, for their modesty and for their hygiene. And as a gay man, I just wanted to comment on his statements that that's a kind of a common myth and assumption that if you're gay and you're in a locker room setting or a shower dorm or anything, that it's just a candy store, and that's absolutely not true, that the ogling doesn't go on. I, for one, am very modest and very respectful of other people, and I find most gay people to be that very same way. So that assumption that just because you're gay that you're just ogling and disrespecting people is absolutely not true.
And thanks very much for your call.
Yeah,
thank you.
Jim makes a great point, and I think you know, as other people have pointed out, if you go to the Y, and okay, you're showering with gay people. I don't. Yet again, I've never seen any problems at all. And the stereotype that somehow they're all perverted and stuff like that is simply not true.
Let's go next on the phones to Bob in Dallas. Hello, Bob.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead.
I just wanted to share a comment that an older relative of mine made who served as an officer on board a heavy cruiser in the Pacific. So he's not a younger generation person. He's in his 80s. And his comment about anybody, sexual orientation, of course, he used a little different phraseology, but he said he really did not care who a person slept with as long as when they were at battle stations, they could do their job. And I think that most military and service personnel would feel pretty much the same way. As long as their buddies got their back, they really aren't concerned about their personal life.
Thanks for your call. Yeah, Larry, it does seem like what we're doing here is essentially asking people to trust that the men and women in our military right now are professional enough to handle this policy change.
Well, that's true, and they are. You know, if you look at the integration of the military, they were out ahead of society. And in this issue, they're somewhat behind, and they are professional. I mean, that, you know, if you're not professional, you're not going to stay in. You're not going to make it through boot camp or basic training. And so I think that's really the critical thing. And that's where you weed out people, you know, who you allow to enlist when you find out they can't be professional in all kinds of things. And they're not willing to put the good of the unit above their, you know, of their own good.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hello. Hey, thanks for your show.
Oh, sure.
Now, my question really gets at if we allow and focus on having gays in the military, how would that affect health care and benefits? And will that then open a can of worms into defining what gay marriage is or domestic partnership is in the United States?
You're talking about things like survivor benefits and family benefits, things like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I just think this may go further than, you know, who's fighting next to you. It may define a culture.
Larry?
Well, I think we can take a lesson from our Canadian and British friends and how they handle it. And similarly, you know, the federal government, you know, has changed its policies in terms of benefits and for, you know, gay people who are working for the federal government. So I think you can work it out along those lines. People have raised, you know, the issue of, well, what happens if, you know, if they get married in a state that says it's legal and they get transferred to, you know, another state. And again, I don't see it as a big problem because let me give you an example of something that happened when I was there. You may remember that in the 80s, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving got a lot of states to raise their drinking age from 18 back to 21. And then the question became, what would we do on the basis? That was really up to us. You know, in other words, my feeling was that if a young man or woman, you know, 18 or 19, we can send them into battle. We ought to allow them to have a beer. But you see what I mean? So I think those issues can be handled. And I think the key thing is, you know, most states and the federal government do provide, you know, for survivors' benefits, and that to me is going to be the key issue, or as well as to allow someone to visit you if you become disabled or have power of attorney.
Do you have any indication at all that the president's intention in putting this out there, or the top military leaders who are at this point supporting it, that they're doing this as a way to sort of start us down a slippery slope and re-examine what marriage is and how it's defined in this country?
Well, I don't think so. I think because I worked in the Obama campaign, and it was really a question of military readiness as well as, you know, integrity, but it was military readiness because, you know, in 2008, we were giving an awful lot. It was over 8,000 moral waivers in the Army. Now, with the horrible economic situation we have, it's not as bad because people are not getting out. And in the numbers that they were, and more people are willing to enlist because they can't get any other job. But no, it was really a question of military readiness. I think the president's been pretty clear about his, you know, feelings on same-sex marriages as opposed to civil unions. Will people try and do that? Yeah, obviously, people will take advantage of any situation to push what they, you know, feel is the, you know, their particular point of view.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak with Don. Hi, Don.
Hi. My name is Don, and I'm a former submariner in the United States Navy, and I just wanted to call and comment on how great it is that this conversation is taking place, because most submariners that I serve with have been asking the question, why hasn't this happened sooner, and why hasn't Don't Ask, Don't Tell gone out the window a long time sooner, because we're a very task-oriented unit, and we don't see homosexuality as interfering in any way, shape, or form. In fact, people who are homophobic or mistreat people who are known to be homosexuals in our units are treated as a racist would be treated in a military unit. They are the ones that are ostracized more than the homosexuals. And I think it's great that finally this is happening and that this conversation is taking place. And I just wanted to thank Larry and yourself for this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for your call. Larry, do you think that even in the media we tend to maybe overstate the amount of homophobia that is in existence in the active members of the military?
Well, I think sometimes we do, because they do a lot of polls. You have a lot of retired, you know, people like, you know, Taylor, who called earlier, who, you know, are not comfortable, with this. Or you get the American Legion and places like that. As I pointed out, I think, you know, even since Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it's hard to believe, you know, time goes by so quick. That was 17 years ago. That's almost a whole new generation of people coming in. And I think it's interesting that Don mentioned, you know, submarines, because a lot of people, if you remember back in 1993 when Clinton was trying to repeal it, you had senators and congressmen climbing over the bunks of the submarines and things like that to show, quote unquote, how horrible this was, this was going to be. But I think that's really, really significant. And I don't know if Don is aware of this, that the Navy is now going to move to allow women to serve on submarines, which had been one thing they had refused to do up until now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Andrew in Dallas. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I just wanted to comment real quick. This is a real simple issue as far as I'm concerned. You know, we have elected officials that are publicly elected by the people that are openly gay. You know, and it's really tragic that we're losing, you know, qualified service people in this. You know, we're fighting a war on two fronts, and we have people that are highly specialized, West Point graduates. You know, that they're getting kicked out of the military because their sexual preference, and it's just, you know, without us having the volunteer service, we can't afford to lose any more qualified service people, especially over, you know, an issue that's already dead and gone. You know, it's the 21st century, guys. Come on, wake up.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, Andrew. In fact, when I looked at the letter that Senator McCain was referring to by the 1,119 retired generals and admirals, none of them had served in the 21st century. And I think, you know, you put it very well, it is the 21st century, and you know, we're in a different, you know, society. And, you know, it's interesting what drives, you know, the military. I mean, back when they integrated the units in Korea, it was battle necessity. They didn't have enough, you know, white soldiers to replace the ones who had been wounded, so they integrated using African Americans. One of the reasons they expanded opportunities for women is when they went to a volunteer military, you were excluding half the population. You couldn't meet your quotas. And, you know, even now with demands on the service being so great and more people who are openly, gay, it's foolish not to allow them to come in if they're otherwise qualified.
Do you expect that we will eventually look back on this period in American military history where it was legal to discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation with the same kind of surprise and almost disbelief that we look back on racial segregation in the military?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think people look back and say, what was the issue? And I think your callers have reflected, you know, that. I mean, you know, you had, you know, like Don was on a submarine saying, well, you know, we weren't concerned about this, you know. No, I think that, you know, we'll look back and say, what was the problem? And it's interesting, the British were absolutely adamant against us. In fact, in 93, when Clinton was trying to change it, and people mentioned, for example, the Israeli military allows openly gay people. I mean, that's a darn good military. People said, yeah, but the British are like us. You know, they got submarines and they deploy and so on and so forth. And they were adamant against it. And they look back now and say, what was the problem? We got a lot of problems, but that wasn't one of them.
So talk about the timetable that you imagine might play out here.
Well, I think what's going to happen is that the military now, in 45 days, will know, Secretary Gates will be able to tell us whether it's legal to, you know, stop throwing out people, you know, who get turned in by third parties. And then people will go over whatever rules and regulations need to be changed, issues like you raised about survivor benefits and same-sex unions and civil unions as opposed to marriage. And then I think that when the defense authorization bill, the bill that gives them their money for the next fiscal year, gets voted on, they'll put on an amendment. This way, you can't invoke cloture, you know, so you can get, you know, a small number of people to prevent this from coming to a vote. That's my guess is what will you know, what will happen. And then in a couple of years, we'll look back and say, given all the other problems we had, why are we so concerned about this?
How do you imagine this might affect military recruitment efforts?
Well, I think overall be positive. Will there be some people who may not join, you know, because of this? Could be, but I think you're going to have a lot more people who wanted to join but have not been able to because they don't want to live a lie.
Mm-hmm. And do you even think that the military will think about recruiting in different ways and in different places than it has before?
Well, the interesting thing is they're going to be allowed back on a lot of campuses that they haven't been allowed on because, you know, of the fact that in, you know, a lot of schools, because the military does not allow openly gay people to serve, the faculty won't let them recruit on the campus. I mean, places, you know, for example, I think Harvard, you know, president mentioned this, you know, recently. She wants to drop the ban so she can do that.
Lawrence J. Korb is Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. You can find his work online at AmericanProgress.org. You can also, he is often published in newspapers and in editorials around the country. Larry, it's been a real pleasure to have you this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.